as I wait, heart of God.
Hello, Growth Group leaders, and welcome to our last Growth Group week of this session. We're going to be in Luke 19. It's a fascinating parable. It's called the Parable of the Minas, not to be confused with the Parable of the Talents. But first, a word from Jonathan about the purpose and vision of Growth Groups, quickly.
Yes, I think it's important for us to understand that the purpose of Growth Groups is not simply to understand what the sermon was. It's to actually take us into a process that recognizes that the sermon is only, in a sense, the beginning, that there is so much more about the subjects that we study together that can be learned, different things that apply to our particular situations, different ways in which the scripture enhances and expands upon the message. Now, we give you a lot of scriptures. We are not expecting you necessarily to read them all. We honestly believe that the more of them you read, the more helpful it will be for you. But we recognize that sometimes there's not time to read them all. And you must do exactly as works for you.
And you know what? That's probably something you should communicate to your growth group members as well, as a leader, that the expectation on them is not to read and study every single verse, but to do as many as they feel comfortable and have time to do.
Yeah, and with the same goes, of course, for the questions. I mean, we give you four questions. We have done every time. But, you know, if you don't get to all four, that's okay. Our purpose is that we should grow in our ability to wrestle with the scripture and allow that to grow our walking with Jesus.
That's good. Well, should we go to the first question then?
Yes, our first question is entitled Political Kingdom. Explain how this parable addresses the disciples' confusion between there being two comings of Christ. What did Jesus accomplish in his first coming? What will he accomplish at his second? And how does the reality of both comings offer us tremendous hope?
Yeah, you know what? The difference between the Gospels, the Synoptic Gospels, is it provides us a lot of fascinating insight about the purposes behind each of them. And while Matthew's Gospel may have the most chapters at 28, Luke's Gospel is actually the longest. It has the most words in the Greek of any of the Gospels. And one of the ways in which he pushes himself a little bit farther than Matthew is that Luke often gives the purpose of Jesus' parables before he records the words of Jesus' parables. So, a couple weeks ago, we looked at the parable of the Pharisee and the tax collector. You might remember that parable began by saying that Jesus said that parable to those who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and treated others with contempt. He's setting up the situation very clearly. He does the same thing here in Luke 19 with the parable of the Minas, in which it begins by saying that he told this parable because, one, they were nearing Jerusalem, and two, they, his disciples, his followers, supposed that the kingdom would appear immediately. Now, Jonathan, why did they have that supposition?
Well, I think that they probably had that supposition because they would be conscious of the reality of certain events in history, that when Herod died, his sons had to go to Rome in order to be appointed king. And that was the normal procedure because Rome was in charge of everything. They would then give somebody the responsibility. His son Archelaus went to Rome, and the events that Jesus describes in this story have an interesting parallels in that. So they would have sort of, that history would have registered with them as he begins to tell this story.
And registered immediately, because he tells this story when he's near Jericho, which is Archelaus's big headquarters. So Jesus, he's so smart, both with the content of his parables and the setting of his parables. Well, anyways, this parable addresses the fact that there are two comings of Christ. And this comes across very clearly in Matthew 13. But, you see, they had different purposes behind each of the comings. The first coming, Jesus accomplished a spiritual redemption. In Colossians 1, it says that Jesus delivered us from the domain of darkness, and he transferred us to the kingdom of his beloved Son, in whom we have redemption. That was accomplished at his first coming. His second coming will be a physical redemption, in which all the promises of the Old Testament will be fulfilled, and some of the promises of the New Testament as well, like this amazing one from Revelation 21, where it says that he will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning or crying or pain anymore, for the former things have passed away. You see, there's mourning and death and tears now, but there won't be after that second physical redemption accomplished at his second coming.
Yes, and Jesus realizes that the disciples and the people are expecting something to happen now. And he wants them to understand that something is indeed going to happen. It's not going to be quite what they anticipate, but there's going to be a delay. There's going to be a delay between the first and his accomplishment of the first and his resurrection.
And the responsibilities
and the
between those comings are the content of our next question.
Right. And so, there's going to be a delay in between the two, and he wants them to understand that. But so the second question is, if you're a Christian, you have been gifted with the gospel and will give an account for how you use this gift in the service of this world and his church. Share with your growth group how you hope to put that kingdom material to work in your one and only life.
Mm. Yeah, so we've identified the mina that Jesus gives, well, that the nobleman gives to his 10 servants. We've identified that mina as the gospel. Now, we've done that for three reasons. You see, here in this parable, each one of the servants is given the exact same amount, one mina. Now, what have we all been given in common? The gospel. Another thing, we see in the previous question that this parable was set up to address what happens in between the two comings, and what happens in between those two comings, but the sharing of the gospel and the bringing in of the Gentiles into the church. And then lastly, the third reason why we think the mina is the gospel is because we see the mina is the one that does the work and not the servants. Follow me to verse 16 of Luke 19, which says that the servant speaks to the Lord saying, "Your mina has made 10 minas more. It wasn't me. It was the mina that did the work." Just like that's what the gospel does here when we share it with unbelievers.
Yes, it's interesting that they give, we have 10 servants given one mina each, all exactly the same, but we only ever hear from three of them in this parable when they come back and report. There's only three of them, but 10 of them were given. I mean, they're given exactly the same amount. And it is that gap in between these two comings where the gospel was in fact accomplished, as you said a few minutes ago. The gospel was accomplished by the first coming and will be fulfilled fully and finally in the second coming.
But we read that we will be held accountable for the way in which we use this kingdom material. In several references we've listed for you in this question, it says things like this out of 2 Corinthians 5. "We all must appear before the judgment seat of Christ so that we may receive what is due for what we have done in the body, both good and also evil." He's going to ask us, "What did you do with that which I have given you?"
Absolutely. And of course, we see the two responses from the first and the second sermon, but our third question addresses the master himself, because the third servant's error was in mistaking his master's character. He thought his master was a severe man, strict, austere, hard, exacting, harsh, demanding, unjust. What is it like to work for such a boss? But then how does your view of God influence the way in which you talk about God and share him with others?
You know, I really hope that this spawns a good conversation in your growth group, because we've all had bad experiences at work, haven't we?
And absolutely.
So many of them are due to the fact that our boss isn't the most Christ-like person out there. Well, I think it's comfortable and safe and right to engage on that conversation to a point before it becomes gossip. But to do so, remembering that that is the kind of view that an unbeliever has before God. An unbeliever thinks that God is strict, austere, hard, demanding, and unjust. But we, as believers who know our Father as a good, good Father, as a good and gracious Master who will give 10 cities to the man who's faithful to him, we know he is that gracious and that aboundingly, overflowingly full of grace and love. And that should influence the way in which we steward the gospel, which is the very good news. And we should share it then as good news.
Yes, because you see, I mean, when you've shared the gospel with somebody, very often the people who want to demean the gospel will often say, well, that's just an insurance policy. All you're trying to do is to say, well, if you accept Jesus, it'll be an insurance policy against hell. Because the picture of God is someone who wants to judge us and wants to punish us. But the God of the whole of Scripture shows that, yes, he's a God of justice who will and judgment will come, but he's a God who has gone over the top in terms of his amazing sacrifice simply to make sure that we are able to be present with him in eternity because he loves us so much. Now, if we present God, as you say, as this judge who wants to punish us, people get one picture of the gospel. But if we present this picture of God, who yes will judge but has done everything to provide a way out for us, the picture is very different. And you know, that is influenced by how we see God.
Right. I think it was A.W. Tozer who said that the most important thing about us is what comes to mind when we think about God. That mental image that we form, that's the most important thing about us. There's truth to that.
There's a lot of truth to that. And sometimes, you know, in a sense, we invent or we adjust who God is to fit what we'd like him to be. Rather than, and this, the purpose of really wrestling with the scripture is to say, what sort of God is this? Rather than, what sort of God can I persuade him he should be?
Right, right. Yeah, the purpose of these growth groups, the purpose of our Christian life is to transform us by the renewing of our minds so that it conforms with the scriptures.
Our last question addresses well done. Often the reward for work well done is more work. Did you know that this will be true in the heaven? Heaven will be a place of activity, not just harps and clouds. Far from drudgery, free from the curse, our responsibilities in heaven will fulfill our inmost desires. Engage together in a little sanctified imagining and speculate on what your future greater responsibilities might be on the new earth.
Yeah, you know, this question is really there to cast doubt on our culture's false cartoon caricature of heaven. You've seen the Far Side commercial of a guy sitting on a cloud strumming a harp and telling his buddy he wished he brought a magazine because it's kind of boring up here. But that's not how the scripture presents our eternal blessed reward in heaven with our Father. Nobody wants to go strum a harp for the rest of their life unless they're really, really good at the harp. I'm not. Nobody longs for that, and yet the scripture teaches us that we should long for our heavenly reward, long for our heavenly home. And that last word, home, is how Hebrews 11 describes heaven. Listen to some of these words out of Hebrews 11. These all died in faith, not having received the things promises, but having seen them and greeted them from afar, and acknowledge that they were strangers and exiles on earth. For people who speak in that way make it clear that they are seeking a homeland. They desire a better country, it says, that is a heavenly one. And that God, he's the one who's preparing for them a city.
Yeah, it's really interesting that Jesus rewards the servants not with more money to invest, but he rewards them with the responsibility to govern cities. Now, you know, our concept of work over here, down here, leaves us, I think, strangely ambivalent in the whole concept of government. But clearly, this is not something about which God felt we should be ambivalent as we look towards the responsibilities we will have in the kingdom. Now, as the question says, we are asking for a little sanctified imagination, but recognizing that God never meant the whole process to be so conflicted as it was, as it is now, what might that look like? If governance took place in a place of harmony and love rather than a place of conflict and competition.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, Genesis 3, the curse is thrown down on Adam against his work. He says to Adam that the ground which provides for him his bread will be cursed because of you, and thorns and thistles will be brought forth from the ground to make his labor difficult. It says that he will sweat. It will be hard. But then in Revelation 22, it says, no longer will there be anything accursed.
So what might that look like?
Mm-hmm. No more may sin and sorrow grow.
Mm. Well, we hope that you'll have a really good discussion about what that... And get practical. You know, what might it really look like to be in a place where governance was necessary, but harmony was present?
That's beautiful. God bless you guys. We'll see you next week.
As I wait, heart of God.